house down on Washington, a rather famous episode, the Maid MacArthur famous, if you recall, and that they were so impressed by the poverty of these veterans that they decided to do something with their money and land. Be that as it may, they were friendly with Roosevelt and Ickes, and I think mainly due to Ickes, they gave the land to the government for the expansion of the hygienic laboratory, as that was renamed at some point there, the NIH. And anyway, now during the war, as I mentioned, so that accounted for the local expansion. And again, it was set up in a remarkably good way that, as I mentioned over lunch, that the people were allowed to do largely what they wanted. It was not set up in the Geheimrat sort of system that you might have expected in a government agency. And I think that's gone on for the most part, continued, and accounts for a lot of the excellence of the NIH. Then, even though I'm very biased towards the intramural program, obviously, I think, though, the big contribution of the NIH was the system of extramural grants. Now, the specific story that accounts for the NIH getting involved in this goes back to a story I heard from Baird Hastings, and I'm sure is correct. He was on the Committee of Medical Research during the war, which, as I said, was part of the OSRD, and the Surgeon Generals of the Army, Navy, were there ex officio, as was Dr. Dyer, who was Director of NIH representing the Public Health Service. And at the end of the war, they distributed all their grants, all the contracts and so forth that they had to the various agencies who wanted it. And Hastings was very friendly with Dyer, and he pushed Dyer into taking, whenever one of the basic grants came up, to taking that for the NIH. And so then the NIH became involved that way in an extramural program. However, the thing that I think is really remarkable for a government agency, and as I say, I marvel at why this was the case, that they set it up, as you know, as grants, not as contracts. And that's a very intriguing concept and has been very important. I mean, it'd be perfectly obvious for a government agency to set up a contract. You want something done. You want something done. However, it set it up as a grant, which meant that you said what you were going to do, you were given a grant to do it, but no strings attached, not saying you were going to do that. Now, of course, you have to report eventually, but you could do something else. And this has been an actually marvelous thing, and it's been very exciting, even though I've not been part of that, to watch this go on. But coming back to the NIH, it was relatively small compared to now when I came, but much bigger than it was. It probably had, I would say, probably 100 professional people, of which probably 20 or 30 were probably Commissioned Corps. The Commissioned Corps ran it. At that time, the Commissioned Corps were all MDs.
When you talk about a Commissioned Corps, it's just my ignorance and not understanding that part of the government arrangement. And you're really like a military officer?
That's right, yes.
Is there a rank involved?
Exactly the same. Yeah, it's very hard to explain because, again, it's very anachronistic. But for the historic reasons I mentioned, the Public Health Service has a Commissioned Corps, which is exactly parallel to the Army and Navy, and exactly the same equivalent ranks. They're called differently, but they have equivalent ranks. For example, if you come in with, say, if you have two two bands on your arms, which would be equivalent to lieutenant senior grade on the in the Navy. You would, I think we were called amusingly past assistant surgeon, or
I was going to ask about that, because on your third paper you're listed that way.
Yeah, it's a rather amusing designation. It means you passed the grade of assistant surgeon by one grade. It's rather amusing. And then four stripes, equivalent to captain in the Navy, would be a medical director. Then there'd be assistant surgeon general, surgeon general. And actually, even though this is, again, terribly anachronistic, and I hate to go into it in detail, it is somewhat relevant to, as I say, the whole recruitment process over the years. And it is a quasi-military organization, in the sense that it doesn't come under the uniform, except during war, where it's fully military. It doesn't come under the uniform military code, but everything else is very parallel. You have access to all the Naval hospital facilities, and the pay is exactly the same. All the bills on pay, retirement, and so forth are parallel with the Army and Navy, which is both a positive and a negative aspect. But it has been very important in recruitment. I mean, we like to believe, and I think it is true, the NIH has done well because it's been so good, it's attracted very good people. But the fact remains also that, as I mentioned again informally to you over lunch, that because there were periods when people had the choice of either coming into the Public Health Service and coming to the NIH, or going into the Army or Navy without necessarily knowing where they'd be assigned, this made the NIH jobs extremely attractive to those people, especially during the Korean and Vietnam Wars, who came from the best schools and had very, very good background. I say the Korean and Vietnam War, I think it was also true in the Second World War, except there the numbers were so much smaller that it was much less of an impact. Nevertheless, people like myself, Kornberg, Heppel, and several others came in under those, at that time. At that time, only MDs were commissioned, later PhDs were commissioned, and a number of people came in under those circumstances. It was a somewhat awkward personnel situation, in the sense that there were two parallel personnel services. One is the Commissioned Corps, who at that time ran things. It's no longer the case. And the civil service, and they had different salary ranks. And parenthetically, this did lead to certain striking inequities. For example, MDs with no training would be assigned to work with PhDs who were very good and who taught them everything, and whose salary was less because of the different personnel system. Nevertheless, it did attract these very good people, and that was particularly important when the clinical center was opened. And I think a very large number of the people who are now professors of medicine in various parts of the country came to the NIH for 2, 3, or 4 years because of the Commissioned Corps arrangement. And again, some of it was somewhat awkward, in the sense that over the years there's been some problems with integrating the rules that the Commissioned Corps have for the entire Public Health Service with the special needs of NIH. But for the most part, the directors of NIH have been strong enough to get the and the Corps has been cooperative enough to make the appropriate adjustments. I mean, one of the most important adjustments was, of course, that people are assigned to NIH and have stayed here, whereas in the rest of the Corps, they rotate, you say. So
okay.
So that was a very important important aspect. But there are other trivia where it didn't, but that are really hardly worth mentioning in the overall picture. I mean, the important thing is that with this personnel system, NIH was able to use either system to attract all these bright young MDs and later PhDs to the developing program. So I don't know if that's clear enough.
Well, I'm assuming that a lot of this happened after the war was over. Was it during the war, was it relatively constant, or was it developing and growing rapidly at that time as well?
Well, you see, they moved down here in 1940 from downtown.
Just before the war started.
And that there was an expansion sort of at that time, a little expansion. And then there was a little expansion during the war in certain, but a small one. But a little bit here and a little bit there. For example, we're working on the, as I mentioned, the role of electrolytes and the treatment of burns and shock with Samuel Rosenthal. I assume that that represented a small expansion of that section. Parenthetically, I might say, when you were in those days, when you were, to show how small it was, when you came to NIH, you were, it wasn't true in my case, but in general, you were allowed to go around and choose which department you worked in. And on a very personal note, which is not really relevant, it's sort of rambling to what we were talking about, when I came to NIH, I had come off the Coast Guard ship, and I was, of course, very pleased to get this assignment. And of course, you report to the head of the institute, which is hard to believe now, the big institute. And so here I went. I went up and told Dr. Dyer I was here, and he wondered where I was staying that night, and I hadn't made any arrangements, so he gave me the keys to a small cottage that the Wilsons used to have, where I stayed the night until I could find a room. So this shows how small and personalized the operation was at the time, and how interested the people like the director were in how things were going.
Was there housing here for personnel on the site?
The housing you see here, but of course even then, this was not enough housing for the group. You see, there are six duplexes for, and now so 12, just 12 families plus one for that used to be for the director and the associate director, and now the secretary of HHS. Assistant secretary who lives there, the one for health. So, but that was even then very small, and as I say, was really based on the historic anachronism when they, even then, when they built the place. I didn't move here till 1949. I mean, onto the grounds. So, So much for the background of, I think, of the NIH and the Public Health Service. The grants, as I came in 43, as you know, in September 43. Let's see. I had a short, again, two incidents might mention that, despite the fact that I'm saying that everything worked well in terms of interactions with the with the Corps, at times it was you could see the complications, but which fortunately, as I say, due to the strength of the NIH directorship, did not interfere. One was right after, about 6 months or 8 months after I was here, the director had received a request for, probably from the Army, for me to be transferred to, must have been a little after that, to on some kind of assignment to evaluate the some aspect of the scientific developments in Japan after we occupied it. Well, certainly I was neither capable for that nor wanted to, but one of my old, I think one of my old professors at our section men in, at Harvard, Stanley Bennett, was in the Army or something related, and asked that I be assigned there, thinking that I would be good for it. Well, fortunately, I didn't have to, although it would have been an interesting assignment. And the second time turned out to be very interesting, but also showed how the complications. At the end of 1945, it was over Christmas, I wasn't married yet, and I was the only unmarried officer in the Washington area in the health service, which also shows how small the group was. And they needed a ship to return. They were using a ship to take back retired, to return to Russia, Russian purchasing commission people and military people who were here learning naval techniques to enter the war against Japan. But since the war against Japan had just ended, fortunately, they wouldn't give them, obviously, ships to take them, their own ships that they had planned to take them back, so they needed an American transport ship. And even though they had their own doctors, they technically had to have an American on board as a doctor, and so I was assigned to take them back. And it was only 2 months, and it went into Odessa, and it was a very interesting trip, but still indicated how the sort of tenuous interaction sometimes between the Corps and the NIH. But again, those are the only two incidents, and in general, I think the interactions in that period were very good and were and they're very good for the NIH. And then gradually, I think more of the top people at NIH became civil service. More of the more people were hired as civil service. So the eventually there was no difference between the two persons. I mean, much less difference between the two personnel systems. Also, during the war, the Commission Corps were in uniform, and that also emphasized the difference. But again, I don't want to overemphasize this. In effect, it did not affect the operation of the NIH, and certainly, except, as I say, it helped in recruiting people. Let's see, so now we're up to...
Well, what was the arrangement? I wanted to. You mentioned this briefly before. I wanted to come back to the journal club.
Oh yeah. Well, I was going to say at this point we're getting right into that.
But perhaps I could.
Okay. Yeah. Please.
I'm looking for the. There was a number of changes of laboratory names and organizational structure.
Yeah.
Was it originally the Department of Physiology?
Well, basically, I think my answer to that is that none of that was important. These were semantic things.
Okay.
For the most part, until we recently moved from one building to the other, I was in the same room, in the same floor, with the same people all along, except for various administrative reasons, the names changed. For example, when I came, there was one National Institute of Health, and then later we developed all the separate institutes, and they incorporated some of the other departments. But I don't the actual names are really of no real significance.
It was originally experimental biology. Was that?
Well, to show how little significance, I really don't. I'd have to look up the actual names. You see,
okay, well, that's fine.
It was a Dr. Rosenthal I think I should interrupt now to say, in connection with that, he was a pharmacologist who had a very real interest in biochemical types of things. He was a very unusual person, very interested in science, not interested in personal development. He had was born in the South, undergraduate degree and MD from Vanderbilt, probably the mid-20s, early 20s, and I guess then went to interned at Hopkins and worked with John Abel, who was a famous pharmacologist of the day and parenthetically important in the founding of the JBC. And during that period, he developed the bromsulfolene test, which is, until recently, widely, perhaps even now, widely used for liver function. And then in 1928 or thereabouts, he came here and was a member of the Pharmacology Society. He had worked in, did a lot of work in sulfhydryl reactions and did one of the some of the earliest work on sulfonylamide and related compounds with Dr. Bauer, who was an organic chemist. And he developed one of the first treatments for mercury poisoning using formaldehyde sulfoxalate that he developed that reduces the mercury to metallic mercury and made less toxic. So anyway, so I came to work with him, and as I mentioned earlier, he had shown that saline was important in the treatment of burns, and so he and I then studied the electrolyte changes in burns and shock. Now, during that period, I also, part of the study, we were studying the treatment of hemorrhage, where he developed some nice techniques for studying hemorrhage in mice. Parenthetically, I might say one of his most important contributions that in just conceptual times, I shouldn't say his most, he had many important contributions, but compared to most of the work in burns and shock that were based on one dog or two rabbits or people's observations and patients, and as he felt as a pharmacologist that statistics were important, and he could show that if he looks at what he studied, you can get any answer you want if you test a single animal. Of course, I think we all know that now, but that was very controversial, his approach. His approach is you had to use large numbers of animals like mice to get any statistically significant result. So we developed methods for burns and hemorrhage and studied the electrolyte changes. And of course, it was terribly important as a war project. Now, the Institute, as I say, was very small, and there were a few of the younger people there, and we got to know each other very well. And in the evenings, I actually did one piece of work with Arthur Kornberg, who was working on folic acid with Cibrel and Daft, and we studied the effect of bleeding, used bleeding to lower the, to put a strain on the animal to test folic acid, the importance of folic acid in red cell regeneration. And so between that work and just a personal friendships, we started having lunch together. And then after a while, we decided that, well, why should we just sit and this perhaps indicates our personalities in the times, why should we just sit and relax at lunch, or why should we argue about political things? Why don't we talk science? Well, we started to do that, and then we realized that, it had to be a little more organized because otherwise more than one person would bring something. So we finally arranged that in rotation we would go over some papers. Now, of course, I didn't realize what a good group was going to be, but it included Arthur Kornberg and Bernie Harka and Leon Heppel, and at the beginning just the four of us, and then several years later Jay Siegmiller came to work with Bernie Harka, and that was our seminar group. And we and we started that just before Arthur went to you want some more?
No.
Just before Arthur went to Corey and Ochoa and Corey, but then and then continued it in full blast when he came back. And and what we did is we went through a lot of the classic papers, which, as I mentioned earlier, were not really well, had not been really gone over well in most biochemistry courses. And we went through all the papers of Warburg. In those days, you knew how to read German, and it was very instructive, very exciting. Harika had his Arthur had had this training with Ochoa and Corey. Leon Heppel had his PhD and his MD. He got his MD at Rochester, but his PhD before that in California. And Harika, of course, was a real biochemist from having received his PhD in Chicago. And I had no real training, as I've told you. So this was extremely valuable to me. They were both extremely good, enthusiastic, smart people, and we went over these papers in a very thorough way with a lot of give and take discussion. And apparently, it's rather amazing, but most people were amazed that we would have a luncheon seminar that was considered so unorthodox because people worried about getting ulcers and so forth. And as far as they know, none of us did.
Yeah.
But this was the beginning of that seminar that we've still kept on. And we were a little more intense then. We had it every day, I think, except Christmas and New Year's. But now I'm afraid we only have it three times a week.
There's a story in that's related about essentially a
concert,
but about someone who didn't come on Christmas Day. There was
it was
a Kornberger said he was very, very bright, but he didn't know if he was dedicated.
Well, it wasn't Christmas Day. I think Christmas Day we didn't have it.
Okay.
But the story it probably applied to some other holiday and could well have been the case. The story I thought you were going to say is that, and even though it's a story, it really indicates the group sort of. At that time in Washington, there was very little music, almost no music going on, and the Library of Congress had some superb, in fact the only real chamber music going on. The Budapest played, was there in residence, and you would the tickets were only 25 cents, I think, but you had to go down Monday morning before the for next Friday's concert and stand in line. And since it was the only thing in town, the line would get long at about 6:30 a.m. And so people would go down, including us and all of us, and wait in line to get the tickets. But since we couldn't waste that time, we would have, on those days, we would have a luncheon seminar online. So that's the story I thought you were going to say. And that's really true, but it's really, I think, quite typical of indicating the intensity of the group. But it was very valuable for all of us, and particularly for me. I was in another building, and coming over there and learning. And then, as I say, even though Sanford Roosevelt was very good and interested in biochemically, he was basically, you know, a pharmacologist, and having access to this group was terribly important to me, and I also imported what I learned there to the group in our building. In addition, we would exchange papers, we would go over them very critically, And it was just a very good arrangement.